Welcome to another episode of Wine and Dine in LA with Anoush, where I get to interview wonderful people in the wine and food world. Today, I have a very exciting interview. I'm sure many of you will find it fascinating. Lots of questions will be asked. I'm here with Michael Zadigian, wine collector. Hi, Michael. How are you?
Great. How are you?
I'm doing wonderful. I'm going to bring the microphone a little bit closer to you. Well, thank you so much for taking time and meeting with me and explaining us what does the wine collector mean and if that's the correct term that we're using.
Well, it's a loaded term because collector could mean you collect things, you gather things. I'd like to think that the right thing with wine is to really have a passion for it, to drink it, to collect it. Not for investment purposes or hoarding or falling in love with labels, but actually the passion of drinking wine. And by drinking wine, I mean the whole experience of it, from the social aspects of it, the intellectual aspects of it, and of course the wine itself. It's a wonderful liquid. It's incapable of lying. Wine will always tell the truth, which people did too. So it is an experience. It does challenge you in so many ways, and I think it's about learning, understanding. Just sheer label collecting is what a lot of people may end up doing. And it's easy to fall into that trap and lose sight of the fact that this is actually meant for enjoyment. It's part of human history as far back as civilization goes, and it's an important part of life for me.
Well, that's a beautiful answer. I think that leads to the next question. How did you get into wine? And from your answers on the first question, I kind of can see that, but why don't you share with us how did you get into wine, and is wine your background? How did you come about this subject?
Well, actually, my first exposure to wine was I was a child. My parents took me to Armenia for a whole summer, and somewhere along the way, we went to a wine place, and my father tasted some wines, and I was fascinated with the idea that you could actually learn about these wines and age them and keep them. And at the time, I asked my dad to buy me a bottle.
How old were you? How old were
I
you?
I was 9.
In Armenia, it should be okay, but I don't think here would be, yeah.
And the man told me that, well, this will age. And I said, well, how long should this be kept? And he said, well, about 7 years. I said, great, I'll be, old enough maybe to drink it. So I took a piece of paper, I wrote down the drinking range, and I wrapped it on the bottle and kept it. And what he didn't tell me is he had to keep it in a cool place. So by the time I was able to drink, or at least at the time, maybe the wine was bad too, I don't know, but it was undrinkable. But it really made an impression on me. And part of it also is the whole relationship between Armenia and wine, which goes back to all
and your
these
dad who bought you the
century.
Wine,
and my father did the deed.
Do you still have the bottle somewhere?
No. This was a long, long time ago. So since then, I've had the interest, and I started with some California wines. And really didn't have the time to understand the world wines, the French wines, because it was just intimidating. It's complicated. So it wasn't until about, 2 decades ago when I started really, really diving into it and made a point of learning how to read these complicated labels. They don't seem so complicated anymore,
well,
but they are intimidating at first.
Just a little background. We're talking about French wine labels, right? Those are the ones who are hard to read and usually Europeans. But before you started getting into the French wines, you just enjoyed the wines, particularly like with dinner or...
Yeah, socially with dinner. I had a small cellar,
mm-hmm.
But it was more of a special occasion kind of a thing. And then I realized really it really should be an important part of life. And so now we drink something pretty much every night. And I think my system is even used to it. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter what we're eating, pizza or steak or things that you wouldn't think wine would go with.
But do you work in the wine industry? What is your background in that sense?
No, I'm a tech person, an early internet guy. We've done some really, really amazing things in the internet world. And I had the fortune to, some years back, when I sold my company, to go pursue some hobbies. And wine was at the top of my list. So I'm not in the wine industry. I have on occasion dabbled as a silent partner in some vineyards in Burgundy. But otherwise, I try to stay on the fun side of it, the drinking side of it, and let somebody else make the wine. I actually, I have limited understanding of winemaking itself, and I don't try to improve that. I focus on tasting, remembering what I tasted, and triangulating and building upon that knowledge, a little bit like an AI algorithm.
Mm-hmm. So try to find similarities between, tasting the wines and remembering the flavors, etc., together with your tech background? Do you see any correlation in that, or they're absolutely completely different?
There is correlation. You try to, use your brain, I guess, is the short answer.
That's a good thing to do.
The important thing is to really learn every time you drink something and put it somewhere in memory.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really interesting because one of the things that's really fun is doing blind tasting, where you challenge that memory and you're able to, go back to something that may have been years ago, a decade ago, and say, I remember that wine. Of course, they evolve in a decade. But so it's all really tricky. Some people compare it to, following baseball, for example.
Mm-hmm.
It's like that. So I really love that aspect of it.
So do I. The short answer, yes, there is. It's fascinating. So you were fascinated by the wine, you liked enjoying it, you liked learning about it. Why did you decide to start also like collecting? Because we're sitting in your wine cellar, and you said this is one of the three cellars that you have. What does it make one to start collecting, and how do you decide what to collect? Do you just, go to the store and buy whatever you see and collect, or there's a thought process to it?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of starts that way. Try this from a store, and then tasting groups, and little by little, I guess you get carried away, is the short answer, and I'm guilty of that. At the time I didn't, I started, I didn't think I'd be where I am now. But I'm not, no regrets at all. So then you start following, I went through the regions of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And
you traveled the regions?
Both travel and study. So mm-hmm. I took a really, but mostly research and tasting. So quickly went to, from California, then to Bordeaux, then I discovered Rhône, and then when I found out that there's this thing called Burgundy, and it's kind of like it was the final stop for me, both the Pinot Noir and the Chardonnay side of it. And it's endless. So, you know, somebody said you need like 270 years to put your arms around Burgundy. So it's just complicated because many, many reasons. The weather produces different, you know, vintages every year. The vineyards are delineated over centuries and centuries for what kind of wine taste and everything they produce. There is just so much to it, and it challenges you. So you know, that was the attraction. And to really understand all that's going on, you need quite a bit of wine. and Burgundy, even some years back, was very difficult to get. And now it's become virtually impossible. It is actually depressing how difficult it is to get Burgundy, attain Burgundy. So really, it's kind of like what it takes. You either play or you don't.
So you chose from the whole world, from all the regions that there are, the most complicated region, which is a region in France called Burgundy that produces mainly wines from Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, because it was the most intriguing for you and the taste the best.
Yeah, the most complexity, the most variation, probably vintage-wise, and also so many micro, small productions.
Mm-hmm. Maybe we can give a little background of, you know, for the listeners who are not familiar, because not everybody is very well versed on the regions of the world, and then, you know, particularly France too. What is Burgundy? Maybe a little background, where it's located, how many, you know, why is it so complicated?
Yeah.
I know it's a lengthy subject, but...
I'll try to put it in a very, very short. Burgundy is 2 or 3 hours south of Paris, 3 hours south of Paris, and it is produces, like you said, Chardonnay and Pinot Noir, and I apologize for the phone. And it was very close to Paris, so it was the arm of, you know, Napoleon had a lot to do with the laws that made Burgundy what it is today. So unlike most places where there's a brand name and that's the name of the vineyard, mm-hmm. right? Or a family name or something. In Burgundy, the vineyard is an entity and it's a commune. So people have different plots within it. So any given owner may have a piece of land in one vineyard, another piece over another vineyard. So it adds this whole dimension mm-hmm. that doesn't really exist in most other regions. And
yes, because I'm sorry to just pause you at the moment. So, for example, if you pick up a bottle of, let's say, Stag's Leap Cabernet Sauvignon, it's very straightforward. Stag's Leap is the producer. Stag's Leap is the district, and it says Napa Valley, and it's California. So it's very straightforward. You know where the wine is, where the location is. But if you pick up a bottle of French bottle, Burgundy, for example, the one that you poured for us today, why don't you explain what does the label mean and how can someone interpret it?
Yeah, so this is a particular vineyard called Meursault Perrier, and it's most people consider this to be the best vineyard in Meursault, the village of Meursault, and Meursault is in Burgundy. Many owners own pieces of Meursault Perrier, and they make their own you know, production of it, and this one is done by Domaine de Montiel. Etienne is a great guy who takes the you know, deep pride in making long-lasting wines, but there are, you know, dozens, maybe a few dozen Meursault Perrier producers.
Mm-hmm.
So to track who produces what and who owns the best, better plots of a given vineyard, and add on top of it what happens in any given vintage,
mm-hmm.
And all the, you know, deaths and the births and the marriages and the divorces that happen in these families, it is just, you know, it's a full-time job. So it's difficult. And so, for example, if you went to Domaine de Montiel, wanted to taste their entire line of wines, mm-hmm. there's like 40 different wines, mm-hmm. and they're all little pieces of this and that and that and that. They don't put them together. Mm-hmm. So Stag's Leap, for example, like you said, okay, so I got a Stag's Leap.
Yeah.
It might say Howell Mountain or, you know, or, yeah. or you know, Stag's Leap District or whatever, but that's where the complexity ends. Here it is.
So who takes care, let's say it's a vineyard and everybody owns a plot. I mean, it's a big plot and everybody has a little chunk. Does everybody take care of their own chunk, or is there a main vineyard proprietor who takes care?
No, there are rules.
And they're assigned, like these two rows are belong to this person.
Yeah, literally, these two rows are yours, the next two rows are the other guys, and so on. And but it is your land. It's mm-hmm. like it's like condos or something.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like exactly like a condominium system, you know. But
yeah, so there's, you know, homeowners association, if you will, mm-hmm. who decides, you know, there are rules when you can pick and all those kinds of things. But probably the biggest rule is irrigation is not mm-hmm. allowed. Mm-hmm. So these vineyards are not irrigated.
Mm-hmm.
Because how can you decide to irrigate?
Yeah.
So they simply don't irrigate. So there are years that are hot mm-hmm. and cold, and you know all sorts of things happen. So that entire summer growing season is encapsulated in that bottle, and it tells a story. And mm-hmm. that's kind of what's cool about it.
That's amazing. So you are collecting. Well, I mean, we talked about the term collecting, but for this purpose, so you're
sure you can call it that.
You are collecting only Burgundy.
No, you know, we love
mostly,
yes. But you know, still have some California, have Spanish, Italian. I'm not into the Rieslings, mm-hmm. I'm sorry to say. But
so no German
also the
wine.
Rhone Valley, and you know, the Grenache-based wines, as well as the Syrah-based wines. Yeah, you know, but predominantly mm-hmm. Red and white Burgundy, and more heavily white Burgundy.
Mm-hmm. So you prefer the whites?
Slightly, but of course, you know, yeah. It's a mood thing.
Uh-huh. I'm trying to figure out what to ask next. There's so many questions. Well, I guess the next question would be, we talked briefly about where you get your wines. So that is, and you mentioned that it's really difficult today to source, to get any wines from Burgundy because the demand is so high and the source is limited. You know, they cannot produce more than they can.
Right. These vineyards we just talked about are delineated and there won't be another inch of it. So that's what it is. There is a distribution system that's antiquated. You know, you have to know, you know, you can't go to the store and get these things. Even if the store has it, they're back there somewhere and allocated to somebody already who may be, you know, 80 years old and has been buying the wines all this time. Of course, even the merchants are getting less and less of it, and the wine is finding its way to secondary markets or even auctions at exorbitant prices. And so there is a driver for, you know, for this, which is, I think, unhealthy. And it makes it difficult for a new person to come in.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's become more of a function of money. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. rather than who is really passionate about the wine, and but there are on the positive side, the quality of wine has improved because there's more value in it, I think. But also, the newer generation is more attentive in the winemaking generation, and winemaking techniques have also improved. But there's still a very limited quantity in there. But there are some exciting new producers. So a new person coming in mm-hmm. And say, how would I get into Burgundy? Well, start at the bottom and find the wines. You know, focus on what you like. Mm-hmm. Forget about the labels. And try all that you can taste. And then you'll find your place, and little by little you can climb this ladder. And it's a long-term game. But it is unfortunate that some of these wines have, they're
out of reach.
Out of reach. They're, yeah. You know, they used to cost X, now they cost 10X.
Mm-hmm. I would like to when
the
we
joke is that it's become like cryptocurrency.
it absolutely is, and I actually wanted to talk about that when we were going to go on a quick break. But when we come back, I'd like to switch the gears from just talking only about a particular region, but maybe you can given ideas and suggestions to if someone who is listening who wants to get into collecting and enjoying, and also what does that also can be like monetary, if you can resell the wines and how to store them properly and how to go about this. You know, a lot of people want to get into the wine, want to save wine, collect wine, enjoy it, but they don't know how. So you can maybe help us with that a little bit. We'll be right back.